Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a new year with the new episode of the Gals of Geekdom podcast. I am one of your hosts, Crystal Williams, and I'm joined by my equally talented, awesome, and smart co-hosts, Lizzie and Jazzy.
And, wow, I'm smart?
Yes.
I'm talented?
Yes, 100%, and my pronouns are she, her.
She, they.
She or he.
Cool. Welcome back to 2022. How is everybody doing?
You know, I was going to say at the end of 2021 that it was wrapping up real nicely. And then right on New Year's Eve, fucking Betty White died.
Oh, yeah.
No. No.
And Sidney Poitier died, too.
Fucking different bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely was like she was so close to 100. It's sad.
She was 100. No, she was 100.
Okay.
Yeah, Betty I'm gonna White say
we're not. I'm not doing this bullshit. She was so close. She was 99. Betty White was 100 years old.
I agree. I agree. I will not argue.
Right. We can't let 2021 have that victory. Come on now.
No.
What victory?
Hey.
There's no victory with COVID. I mean the way the world's changed since the pandemic. I'm not talking about whatever. We're gonna get into some heavy shit at some point, like we always do. But rest in peace to Betty White, one of the most talented comedic people ever.
One of the most talented lights that has ever shined on this earth. She was a wonderful human being, and we are fortunate as a species to have had her with us for as long as we did.
Hard agree. Also, today was the news of Sidney Poitier's death as well. Don't want to forget about him, since he was the first Black man to win the Academy Award for actor, so that is a huge step and also deserves to be recognized too. So two amazing talents. Mm-hmm. The gals send their love too.
Yeah.
But you know what was interesting about the last episode we did? Somebody here had seen a certain movie before the rest of us had. I think the movie was called Spidey-Man. The adventures of
Spidey Boy,
Spidey Boy, and the adventures of young Spidey friends. Right? Is that what it's called?
Right. I think so. I think that was what it was called.
Okay. yes, we are going to talk about Spider-Man: No Way Home. Finally, like we did a little, you did a little bit in the last episode, Jazzy, but we're going to actually do some spoilers. So I don't know. Skip ahead if you haven't seen. Why haven't you seen it? Like at this point, like if you want to see it, you should have already fucking saw it. Okay.
Right. Like we gave you guys a few weeks at this point.
We gave you almost a month. Right.
So, it's almost don't been point a month. That out. Don't point that out to me, please. I don't have that in me.
So
to acknowledge that it's been a month.
Okay.
To kind of reiterate my own opinion on No Way Home, I do want to rewatch it again, but I will say, as of now, I think it is probably my third favorite Spider-Man movie ever made, just under Spider-Man 2 and Into the Spider-Verse. Considering I was rather underwhelmed by the MCU outings at that point, this one actually came in and surprised me a bit.
I'm so glad to hear that. yeah, at that point, I was just like, you know, everybody was talking about it. When you brought it up, everyone was talking about Spider-Man, and I was very close to seeing it, but hadn't seen it at that point. And I was just like, I want to see it now. And then your review made me super excited. And with my opinions, I guess I'll say that I fucking loved it.
Yeah,
but that's not surprising. I mean, it's a love letter to everything that I loved about Spider-Man so far, the live-action outings. It was an incredibly great closure to that trilogy in the MCU. it was a satisfying closure to it, and it also like brought everything together in a way that was like that should not have worked, but worked beautifully well, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Lizzie, do you have similar?
Alfred Molina is a DILF.
Well, that's all you need to know. That's
the... is he a GILF?
No.
I feel is he a grandfather?
I don't know, and I don't care. I hate that term.
You do? Oh, okay.
Yeah, is it bad?
I did.
Alfred Molina is a DILF.
Okay.
And I'm very happy that he's having his time to shine about that at the moment.
Having seen the movie, I do.
Yes.
I do think that. Well, one, you're right, and I'm saying this as a gay woman.
Look, I'm gay as fucking rainbows, and I'd fuck Alfred Molina. So.
Who wouldn't?
That's see, a better world question. Peace. World peace. World is peace. Found. It can be achieved.
I also have to say that I think something that I loved, and I'm sure you're going to echo the same sentiments as including Alfred Molina, is that the performances of the cast were phenomenal in that everyone seemed to not only want to give it their all, but wanted to give closure to the works that they had done in the past in ways that I could just tell. It didn't feel phoned in to me. I don't know how you felt.
Let me hear real quick. Number one, spoilers. I don't know if we made that clear.
I made that very clear. Yeah.
I know we did, but my brain was like, did we say spoilers? Hi, I have ADHD. We said that 5 minutes ago. Anyway. Yes. Okay. Tobey Maguire. Every single frame of this film that Tobey Maguire was in, I wanted to cry.
It was magical.
Look,
during the scene where he and Andrew showed up, both times I was yelling in happiness in the theater. I didn't fucking care if I was in the theater. This was what I wanted in a movie for a long fucking time.
Just being in the theater with other people, because I was actually in, it wasn't like opening weekend, but it was still a pretty full theater I was in. Just to hear the audience's reaction to it with my own was like a palpable, like it's one of those like movie going experiences, like that's only benefited from being with other people excited, you know, like I mean, I had the obvious feelings and inclinations that they would be in the movie, but just seeing it actually happen was like mind blowing.
Well, yeah, it was spectacular, like, and the moment, here's the thing, and I don't know if that makes me sound smart or anything, but the moment we see Andrew's Spider-Man for the very first second we see it, like, I knew immediately that that was Andrew Garfield's.
Me too.
That's not Tom Holland.
Right, no. I recognize Spider-Man suits pretty easily, and I knew that when I first saw him from a distance. Even then, I knew that was the Amazing Spider-Man suit.
But then he takes it off. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and you see his face, and it's like, oh my god, it's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we stand Tobey Maguire dressed as a cool youth pastor.
Yes.
Look, I saw a tweet where it was like people were saying that Tobey Maguire's entrance in this film was underwhelming as fuck. It's like, dude, it's Tobey fucking Maguire. That's not why? Underwhelming. That's magical.
Why? Well, that's the thing. Tobey Maguire, why do you... He doesn't need a grandiose buildup. First of all, some sort of big grandiose buildup for Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man would not fit Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man at all.
He was the very down his luck average Joe, you know?
Yeah, like Spider-Man in general, but especially Tobey Spider-Man, like, he's not Superman. He's not a god, he's a guy.
He's a dork.
Right. It would have felt, It would have felt so forced if they had a moment of, like, he's in the super suit and the music swells up and everything. I don't know. I don't think I would have liked that as much.
I think letting Tobey Maguire, having him enter the frame as Peter Parker and not as Spider-Man.
Yeah, because that's what his films were, right? I mean, like
his films were more about Peter Parker than they were about Spider-Man. Yeah,
I always thought Andrew was a better Spider-Man, but Toby was a better Peter Parker. So it makes sense to me that that's how each actor entered the scene.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's a pretty universally agreed upon opinion, and I feel like that was intentional. So I feel like that was very intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Which was these two actors, but I'm sorry, also though the scene I'm jumping around a little bit, but that scene where Tom Holland Spider-Man meets Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire for the first time, that's such a good fucking scene.
Yes.
It's just so fucking good.
I did think they would be in the movie. Like, I had the feeling, but I wasn't 100% certain, but I didn't realize how long they would be in the movie for and how much they would be given.
What I liked about it is that, see, one thing I have a problem with a lot of MCU films is that when there's fan service, it's usually just there to exist and it feels forced. Like, one of the most egregious examples for me personally was Falcon's cameo in Ant-Man. Like, you could have done the whole fucking movie without that. That was so unneeded. I like Falcon, but this one, it felt like the fan service had a point. It had purpose in the story, and the characters were characters.
Right. That's what I was gonna get at. That, I mean, those scenes were, you know, it made me emotional in the theater. Like, I had tears. And, like, I don't know, it was just, it was beautifully handled. Like, making it an incredible, like, an emotional sequence worked. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't feel like they were just there to kick ass at the end. It felt like they were just their characters. It was a continuation of their stories. And it felt so natural.
Well, exactly. Is they really kind of let the respective Peter Parkers, like, feel like they had evolved forward in a way that made sense, and let them, like, in particular, Andrew Garfield catching MJ. I was like,
that was so good, and
it was so perfect.
It felt like it gave proper closure to everything this fucking character went through in his respective movies.
Right.
Because he finally got to redeem himself for what was ultimately his greatest failure. Because say what you will about The Amazing Spider-Man 2, but I feel like the moment of Gwen Stacy's death is kind of this big emotional gut punch. And I feel like now it's kind of made retroactively a bit better with this scene, actually.
I think so, too.
Well, it makes it better. Well, part of the problem with that, with The Amazing Spider-Man 2, is that we never made The Amazing Spider-Man 3. So that's just the end of that story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's awful.
Yeah.
It leaves just a further bitter taste in your mouth about the whole ordeal, because Gwen Stacy is dead and we get no closure for Peter about that at all. So getting to have that now is extreme. Makes those movies better.
So it's funny because it's interesting because those movies will definitely be viewed in a like both the Maguire and the Garfield films will be kind of seen in a different light due to this movie. Like, during New Year's Eve, I actually did a viewing of Spider-Man 2 with a few friends. Basically, we synced it up so that pizza time would play at midnight during Central Time. It was a lot of fun. And it was interesting how I kind of viewed that film knowing that what'll happen now. Like, because for years, the only follow-up to that film was Spider-Man 3.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But now, I'm viewing it with that as well as No Way Home, because now we basically have... Because No Way Home is not only a third Tom Holland Spidey movie, but a fourth Tobey Maguire film and a third Andrew Garfield one.
Yeah, and the movie used its time well to conclude those storylines. I mean, giving Andrew Garfield the closure with catching MJ, or like Tobey Maguire and Alfred Molina having their conversation about the ending of, you know, like, because there was, I don't know, it just was so, this is definitely like one of those rare times where this high concept idea that's wanted by fans so deeply delivers on all fronts.
Right.
And, well, it really does. And I was going to say, I'm not really one to over hyper fixate on lore. I think that's a little bit of a waste of the time all the time, but I saw a lot of people commenting that they didn't understand why Toby and Andrew's Spider-Man came through like at their stated, like what in the timeline would be their like 2022 counterparts of existing, whereas all of the villains came through right before they died. And I find that to be a strange criticism, because the reason for that is the fact that it brought them through at like their most recent point of existence, and these people are dead. So that's why that's when they got plucked out of their existence.
It wasn't it also that everyone that knew,
mm-hmm.
everyone that yes. knew Peter Parker's Spider-Man. So that's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of that adds to that. I mean, they just filled out that story there. That mm-hmm. answers that question for you.
I don't know. People were strange about. I dislike when we hyperfixate on the lore and whether or not it makes sense. I care about the emotional resolution.
If you really want to nitpick into it, there's a few things in this premise and a few character inclusions that are kind of head-tilting. Like, you could argue it's a bit weird that Electro is here, considering he never found out that Peter was Spider-Man. But who the fuck cares? I want to see Jamie Foxx's Electro again.
Who the fuck cares? Jamie Foxx got to play a cooler version of Electro.
Right? I find it funny that he wasn't the main focus in terms of antagonists, and yet he was a way more compelling character here than he was in the fucking Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Yes, he was. You know, your point about people hyper-fixating on, like, the idea of lore is something I've seen, and I don't want to get into this because I want to stay on Spider-Man, but I want to just briefly mention what I've been seeing, is that the Star Wars fans hyper-fixating on the recent episodes of Boba Fett.
Oh, no! The shot of Boba looking at his dead father's helmet looks better now because it better emphasizes the kid's loneliness. Oh, darn, they went back and fixed some really bad shot composition.
No, but it's bad continuity, Jazzy.
But, you know, also to the fact that it's a fucking memory.
I know, right? Why does he have to remember it exactly the way it was shown to us from an entirely different character's perspective?
Like, who the fuck cares that they didn't get some shitty CG in the background there? Like, oh god, how dare they? And again, that scene was shot horribly in the original Attack of the Clones, but then again, I'm a bit biased because I fucking hate Attack of the Clones.
Attack of the Clones is the worst Star Wars movie.
It is! I cannot.
It is the worst Star Wars. Like,
micro rant, and then let's get back to Spider-Man. But I cannot believe that people, honest to God, say that Rise of Skywalker is the worst this series has gone, when at the very least, I can watch Rise of Skywalker. It's a bad time. But...
Okay. Well, the acting and the shot composition in Rise of Skywalker is competent.
Right. It's at least a competently made movie the technical front.
Exactly. And this is what I always say. This is why I even, like, put aside for a second how much you do or don't like The Last Jedi. When I would hear Nerd Bros, this was the worst movie ever made, I'm like, wow, you have been blessed with the kind of movies you've seen if you think this is the worst movie you've ever seen. Like, you cannot take a movie as, like, objectively well made as Last Jedi and tell me that that's the worst film you've ever seen. I'm sorry, well, that's just not true.
But don't you know the prequels are good now?
I actually have a recommendation before we get back into Spider-Man, but it's on the Star Wars kick because I just remembered it. It's a documentary. It's called The Prequels Strike Back. I know the title sounds a little bit like hokey, but the documentary is actually filled with a lot of really interesting perspectives if you're a Star Wars fan on the way that we view the certain generations view the newest versions of Star Wars. I don't know. That's a recommendation I'm going to make out there. So it's a little indie documentary called The Prequel Strike Back, and it's very good and well balanced.
Right. I'll just end this micro tangent by saying that no hyperbole, Attack of the Clones is a fucking cinematic disaster. Why do people like this movie?
Nostalgia.
I'm sorry.
It's because who were small children when they saw it.
I don't mean to step on too many toes. If you like it, you like it, but you're wrong.
Like, I have a lot of affection for Revenge of the Sith because it was the first Star Wars movie I ever saw in a theater. Like,
oh, same. But I'm not gonna act like
it's Revenge just always of the gonna.
I'm not gonna act like Revenge of the Sith was that well made. It wasn't.
It was better than Attack of the Clones. But again, Star Wars.
Anyway, Spider-Man.
Going on to the next Disney property. Back to the original Disney property. Or I guess Sony.
Mm-hmm.
Sony, Disney, same thing. Disney, there we go.
Okay. So, Aunt May.
Oh, God.
No, the moment she started saying those words, I was like, no, May, shut up!
No, not hot Aunt May.
Stop talking!
It's sad because I didn't
Stop
like...
Stop talking, I, May!
It's sad because I wasn't the biggest fan of this version of Aunt May for the first two films. This film really made me warm up to her, and then they fucking killed her. Like, I actually really liked this version of Aunt May in this film, and I was surprised I did considering I couldn't care less for her before this point.
I was just straight up sitting there like, no. Don't say that.
That sucks though, because she's one of the people who got snapped out of existence in Infinity War.
I know, it's not fair. It's like really not fair. It's like impressively, like May is really getting the raw end of the stick in the MCU. It's very not fair.
I also want to say that while I have a lot of praise for the performances in this movie, particularly Tom Holland, who I am so glad was allowed to carry a Spider-Man film on his own for fucking once. Thank you, God. As well as Andrew Garfield, Tobey Maguire, and Alfred Molina. The standout performance to me was Willem goddamn Dafoe.
Oh, of course. Fucking goat.
Like
go ahead. Sorry.
This performance was terrifying, and I'll tell you why. Why this performance gave me so much anxiety in the best way, because I knew that the goblin persona was hidden there somewhere. I was just wondering, when the fuck is that evil bastard gonna come out?
You're just sitting there waiting, and it's... That scene where Peter's Spidey sense goes off because mm-hmm. the goblin was about to come out, it's so fucking good.
Yeah, just... Oh,
and that, I think that's one of my favorite visualizations of Peter experiencing his Spidey sense that I've actually seen in live action. It was so good. It was such a great fucking shot. And mm-hmm. Tom Holland did such a good job.
Also with Willem Dafoe, he said the thing.
Yeah, there was definitely some moments and callbacks and memes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, literally in the theater as soon as he said that, I just went, he said the thing.
that joke was made for the nerds, so I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was made for, especially considering the Tobey Maguire films have like a fountain of memes. So
that's true. Also, we're the first moment I kind of gasped in the movie a bit too. Is like was excited about was seeing Charlie Cox back as Daredevil for that one scene.
Okay. That was the one, that was like one of three things about the movie that wasn't spoiled for me. I didn't know. And my poor girlfriend, I like punched her in the arm. I was like, ah!
Like, I'm not exaggerating. When the theater I was with, the entire audience audibly gasped.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
With Andrew, they were like clapping. With Daredevil, it was like.
Because you know what? With Andrew and Toby, we already kind of knew. Like, yes, they were publicly denying it, but we knew. We knew.
Did you hear that they apparently attended the film opening night in, like, disguises, apparently?
I love it.
But also, I have to say, in terms of the MCU characters that assist Spidey throughout each films, with Iron Man in Homecoming, Nick Fury in Far From Home, I gotta say, Doctor Strange in No Way Home is probably my favorite because, one, I fucking love Doctor Strange. He's one of my favorite characters to come out of this universe.
Yeah.
Two, hot take real quick. The Doctor Strange wig was not good in this movie.
I didn't notice it.
I
noticed it immediately.
But two, like, it felt like he wasn't a huge part of the plot. He had a supporting role to play and he played it. And that was, again, it was fan service on necessity. Like, it didn't feel like he was overshadowing Spider-Man, which, as you recall, was a big problem I had with Iron Man in Spider-Man.
Guys, real quick, I've actually got a call. I'll be right back.
Okay. Do we want to pause or?
No, let's just keep going.
Ahead, keep talking. It's fine.
Okay. But yeah, like I said, if you remember from the last podcast we did at the year, I said one of my biggest problems with Homecoming was it felt that Iron Man was way too intrusive into Homecoming's plot, as well as Far From Home's to a slightly lesser extent.
Mm-hmm.
This one, Strange felt like, first of all, I'm so happy there wasn't a last minute twist where one of the villains had it out for fucking Tony Stark. Thank you. I was so annoyed with that in Far From Home. You have no idea.
And that's funny because it doesn't bother me, but everyone has their own opinions and stuff. We've talked about this before.
Right. Strange not only is a good character in the story, but he also kind of benefits the film in terms of what they could do with it. Like, that entire fight scene between him and Spidey was so good because it's literally putting Spider-Man into the trippy shit that Doctor Strange can do, and that's amazing.
Definitely.
That scene was amazing when they were fighting in the mirror dimension.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Like, it felt like the writers actually thought, okay, we have this character from this film in our Spider-Man film. What can we do with him? And it felt like they used him to full effect without him overshadowing the title character, which I appreciate. In fact, I'll also say the cinematography in general was far better in this movie than the previous two MCU Spidey films, honestly.
Yeah, I'm gonna be honest. The direction, John Watts' direction, has not overwhelmingly impressed me with the first two.
Yeah, this one was, it felt like this one, he legit wanted to make this movie and he had a blast making it.
Yeah, I think they had a lot more fun with this one than.
Because I felt the cinematography in the previous two films was kind of bland, boring, uninspired. This one was so visually interesting, and it felt like it was taking inspiration from all the previous Spidey films to make it work. Not all of it hits a home run, but I think it does well enough that I came out of here actually remembering this film, which is wow, I remembered an MCU Spider-Man film. This is impressive.
I'm so glad that you ended up loving it.
This film melted my cynical ass heart, I swear.
It like, certainly did.
You know that scene with the critic in fucking Ratatouille? That was me.
Okay, so question now. Do you guys think that Ned and MJ are done? Like, do you think that they're gonna move on to, like, Gwen Stacy and Harry Osborn or whoever in the next Spider-Man trilogy?
As sad as I am to say it, yeah, I think they're done. As much as I love them as characters, I think, I don't know, this, it feels like a tragic but satisfying way to cap off the story of with this particular Spidey story with those two as his friends, you know?
Well, it's also a very Peter Parker-esque sacrifice.
Right, right. It's the first time in a while I felt they really exemplified in an MCU Spider-Man film the idea of responsibility, something I was looking for a long fucking time, and I'm so happy they finally did it.
It's because in the early stages of what they were doing with Peter Parker as a character is they really were leaning more into the fact that he is a teenager again. And so the message... The message with Peter Parker, he was simultaneously working as, like, a lesson for Tony Stark at the beginning, more so than he was operating as his own character. And then after that, like, it was a lot more of a, this child shouldn't have the weight of the world on his shoulders like this. Which is true. But that was far more the message of the first few outings for Tom Holland's Spider-Man. And now he's done with school and he's becoming more of an adult. And so they're leaning more into him stepping up and taking on his responsibility as a superhero.
Right. It's a nice way to cap off this series of films. I still think it works pretty well as a trilogy. I don't hate it as much as Jazzy does. I
don't hate these movies. I want to emphasize that. I don't hate them.
Maybe I said hate is the wrong word. You just don't like them as much.
I'll say this. This film does make me want to go back and rewatch the first two MCU Spider-Man films, because once I saw what they did with this character, where it was all building up to, I can't help but wonder if it's going to retroactively make experiencing the other two films better for me.
Maybe so. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It does feel like the first two were building him up. Like, this was all character development for him to step into the Spider-Man that we know. You know?
Right, yeah. Right. Now that I see that's where they were going, now it's like, oh, okay, I wonder if these other two films will be better experiences for me, because this film does a great job at addressing what was ultimately my core problem with these films. I think this is easily the strongest of the trilogy. Like, this was easily the best of the MCU Spider-Man films, and I'm even counting the ones where he was a side character, such as counting all the Spider-Man MCU Spider-Man films and Civil War, Infinity War, and Endgame. I think this is easily Tom Holland's best outing as the character.
Yes,
and
I agree.
I really loved that his new little apartment. It looks just like Toby's.
I was so hoping for a Mr. Ditkovich cameo. You have no idea.
I think the only thing I wanted to see in this movie, and this was just hopeful, I'd wish we'd seen a little bit of, like, their respective worlds. Off the end of the movie. But
it would have been nice to see Andrew and Toby, like, returning to their New York.
And see, like, a Kirsten Dunst cameo. I don't know. I think that would have broke
the budget.
maybe, but I don't think the film is any less for not having those. But I was sitting in the theater going, I want to see that. You know, like, can we see a little bit of that?
You know, this isn't really a problem with the film, but one thing I was kind of hoping for at a specific moment when Jamie Foxx said he was kind of hoping Spider-Man was a black guy. I was kind of hoping for a 30 frames per second animated Miles Morales to swing in. Like, I don't care if it would have been fucking stupid. It would have been cool. But that's not a fault against the film. That's just me going, oh man, wouldn't that be awesome if this happened?
I think this is our wish fulfillment section where we're like, you know, we wanted these little things. It doesn't make the film any less for not having it, but... Mm-hmm.
For the most part, this film gave me what I wanted, honestly. So again,
I agree.
I think the biggest thing I would have wanted is if, like, when Peter gets the shitty apartment, is if, like, his landlord was Mr. Ditkovich. I think that would have been funny.
That would have been a funny way to cap off the movie, but I do like the ending where it's... Mm-hmm. Well, they do give you the comedy moment with the whole Venom bit that they do.
Oh, yeah. I will say, I was kind of hoping they'd do more with Tom Hardy's Venom, but...
That was funny, though. Yeah. Why was he there? Tom Hardy doesn't know who the fuck Peter Parker is. Why was he there?
He was. Oh yeah. Why was he there?
Why? He doesn't even have a fucking Peter Parker.
It's because they set it up in his movie.
Because fan service. Again, it's same reason why Electro was there, despite not knowing who that Spider-Man is, Peter Parker.
Oh, but that was very funny though. That I love this idea that Tom Hardy just spent like 2 days.
The entire movie studying up
just in like war. Panicked in this Mexican bar.
Actually, you know what? That fits even better. Yeah. Like, I was like, is he gonna like come in at the last half of the movie? But like, no, I feel like this is better. Like,
they also set up an MCU version of Venom.
Yeah, which is nice.
Which is what it is. But like, it's very funny.
I agree. So it sounds like our overall opinion is we all really like the movie. I don't know.
It's kind of hard because I really like Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, but this might be standing toe to toe with it as my favorite MCU film. No lie, I really fucking like this movie.
This is definitely one of the top of the MCU for me. I don't know where it ranks, but yeah, it's up there. And I'm also kind of with you on, I think it's my third favorite Spider-Man. It might be my second. I feel like like one or two of them might be interchangeable. Like, it's hard for me to just, like, yeah.
I still think, two, in terms of the live-action films, I think two is better just because I felt the story, I still dig the story and characterization a bit more in that one, and Spider-Verse is just the best on the grounds of being Spider-Verse.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I have a lot of emotional connection to the Raimi movies. They're special to me, as they are to most people my age. I'm discovering this to be a trend. I've yet to meet someone within my general age group that if you care at all about superhero movies. Like, there's people who don't give a fuck, but like, I've yet to meet someone within my general age group that loves superhero movies that doesn't have some sort of like intense emotional connection to the original Raimi movies. So.
Oh, me too. I think the Raimi films are what really got me into superhero films. You know.
Yeah. That was kind of, those were the superhero films I grew up with. Like, I saw each entry in the trilogy as they were released. Like,
yeah, me
I didn't
too.
See, I didn't see Spider-Man 1 in theaters. I saw it when it came out on DVD, but the other two I did see like pretty close to opening day, actually, because I loved the first one so much.
I saw all three in theaters, I believe.
I love all three of them. I even really like Spider-Man 3 for as dumb and as fucking stupid as it is.
Yeah, having rewatched it, it's like way better.
Like, I'll say this. Did you know that Spider-Man 3 has an editor's cut?
Yeah, that's the one I watched.
Yeah, it is a, I think it is a much better version of Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, I can't like compare because I hadn't seen the Spider-Man 3 probably since the year it released. But I watched it and I'm just like remembering everything. And I'm like listening to like all the other people explaining what was different. I kind of have to agree that I think that version is superior.
The thing I love about the editor's cut of Spider-Man 3 is that there's a slow build to him using the black suit more constantly. So it's portrayed more like a drug addiction.
Yeah, it definitely builds up everything a bit better.
Certain scenes are rearranged to make it work better.
Yeah, I agree. I think that should be like the definitive one people should probably watch if they're gonna watch Spider-Man 3.
But here's the thing: it's only available on a specific box set of the Raimi trilogy, which I think is kind of dumb. This should be available like in an individual Blu-ray as well, I feel. So
is it digital? I think it's a digital release of it, right?
Well,
No. I have the physical disc with it. It was released on a box set trilogy of the Raimi films.
Which I have. Bonus, I have that one, yeah.
On a bonus disc. And it wasn't even advertised on the front. It's a bullet point on the back, and it's like, what the fuck?
With any luck, the new movie re-sparking interest in the original Sam Raimi trilogy will possibly bring about a re-release of that.
I could see that happening, like a giant box set, you know.
Yeah,
that would be pretty cool.
Just the increase in marketability and interest in and for that.
So Spider-Man's is good.
So yeah, Spider-Man is good movie. Do you want to talk about the slightly heavier topic we were planning on discussing?
Aha! Yes.
Oh, so we
before,
have to, we...
before my recording device dies, let's get on that.
Okay.
Sorry. So recently, YouTuber video essayist Lindsay Ellis posted a very lengthy essay on her Patreon, which basically, to sum it up, is her officially retiring from YouTube videos due to a lot of harassment and stuff that's been going on since last year due to, I don't think the harassment necessarily started with the riot tweet, but it was definitely a huge catalyst, so, or a huge point of the harassment.
Yeah. So I have many thoughts.
Same.
To start with, Lindsay Ellis is a lot of things to me.
Mm-hmm.
She was really the person who made me, I have said many, many times before, and I will still quite frequently say it, is that Lindsay Ellis is who I want to be when I grow up. She made me realize that you could talk about film the way that she does. She made me, because I started watching her, you know, when I was into Channel Awesome stuff in high school. I remember the first time I ever heard, talking about her film academia background and just sitting there thinking, I want that. I want to do that. So in that way, Lindsay Ellis was always really important to me. And that was part of why, as I got older and her content started to frustrate me more, it made me, I think, as angry as it did for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a period of time where I was really, really resentful about Lindsay Ellis and her, and a lot of her takes. A lot of what she had to say was really frustrating. She would say things that I just so blatantly disagree with. But no matter how frustrated or angry I ever got with Lindsay Ellis, I would never, ever, ever purport to say she didn't know what she was talking about or that she was stupid, because she certainly never either of those things. Even in her worst takes, they were almost always very thoughtful and nuanced.
Mm.
And I think that in a lot of ways, she pushed YouTube and film discourse on YouTube and stuff overall to me in a very positive direction. I think that she forced everyone to be a lot more introspective and thoughtful with the way they talked about art and film. I think she perfected a new medium and art form through which to talk about these things, and I think that's great. That being said... That being said, Lindsay Ellis has had so very many terrible takes and so very many unthought out ideas and things that she just pops off on the internet without thinking, and that's always been frustrating, and it's always been annoying, and it's always comes with this intrinsic air of extreme surety that she is correct, and I think that that had a lot to do with why the backlash to the Raya tweet was as bad as it was. is because Lindsay Ellis as a person has never been very capable of publicly taking accountability for when she said something stupid.
Right, because, like, there was a lot of harassment for that one that went way too fucking far, but there was genuine criticism to be had of what she said and how she worded it. And quite frankly, I think that's also reflective of her goodbye essay as well, because while I feel bad for her, I wasn't exactly a fan of her comparing her situation, a cisgender best-selling author, comparing her situation to Isabel Fall, which, fuck, like, Lindsay, I feel bad, but fuck off, please.
I will say, to an extent, I find when people are making comparisons of that nature in situations like this, I think they're more just, like, especially specifically in her say, I didn't feel like she was necessarily saying it was the same so much as she was just kind of, like, saying, I found solidarity and comfort in...
Yeah, to give credit to her, in her actual essay, she does say that she's not trying to compare herself to that. I think she was just trying to find a way to make the point that she was attempting to make, as opposed to necessarily drawing a direct comparison.
I'm still a bit on using the comparison in her situation. I don't know. I'm kind of mixed on it, admittedly.
Yeah, no, you can think that was in bad taste. I don't think she was trying to say that it was the same. I think that she just found a lot of solidarity in Isabel Fall's words. And was using them. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that was a correct thing for her to do. So, like...
I think there's a lot of layers to this and why it happened the way it did.
Obviously, I will say... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, just obviously one of the reasons why she received such intense backlash is because of the rabid nature with people want to tear down queer women. I feel like in some ways I was blind to some of it. I understood it, right? I don't think I've always been helpful in this conversation. And I feel like when this essay dropped, it made me like reevaluate a lot of things about myself. If anyone's following me on Twitter, they probably saw a lot of it because I was talking about it for like a good week. But I think I've always been a supporter of our community and I really care and I always super care. And I feel like her situation got exponentially worse because of the ripple effects that the Natalie Wynn Buck Angel controversy kicked off first. I feel like there's a tendency online to expect things of certain people. And when they're either misword things or they don't adequately put it or whatever, to be fearful, I will say this is from a leftist perspective, to be fearful that someone might not actually be the ally that they claim to be. And I feel like that fear, which I think in some ways is genuine to be concerned about, has led to people not really realizing the extent of which their words have an impact on somebody who who also exists online and who is a person, right? Like,
right.
I think there's an analogy that says the snowflake doesn't feel sorry for the avalanche, right? The individuals, all of us who commented on these situations led to a fucking avalanche that has caused genuine harm and hurt. I deleted a lot of the stuff I said in the past, but I was pretty critical of Natalie Wynn when things went down the way they did. I never, like, I would say was abusive. I didn't, like, tweet much about it. I did tweet vague things or reply in certain things. But I was a fan of hers, and then I was frustrated when that situation happened. And then the canceling video came out, and I got even more frustrated because I had interpreted it as someone trying to dodge responsibility for things. But in a lot of ways, I was wrong in that analysis. I feel like I was at a vulnerable point where I was still in the closet, and I saw something that I felt like I could say. I don't know if I felt like, you know, like, or that those feelings were wanting to do something about something, right? Having some sort of power of understanding, but I, in my care of the entire situation, I neglected to look at the individual and the reasoning why things happened and how minor it is in comparison to a lot of things. So I feel like the reason why overall why Lindsay got so much backlash was still because of the Natalie situation. And that, speaking as someone who initially criticized Lindsay when that tweet came out and then kind of deleted and pushed back, I could understand the frustration because there was already a sense of frustration, I guess for me, with that entire community of quote unquote Brett Dube, where it was like, you know, Philosophy Tube, you know, Natalie and Lindsay. There was definitely a sense of untrust. And I feel like in Twitter spaces, these sorts of fears and anxieties get kind of pushed forward, like even more so, and negative traction gains more negative responses, meaning more negative people posting negative things and not really thinking about the entire scope of said situations. So yeah. I had been wanting to say that I deeply regret a lot of the feelings that I had because it was misinterpreted. So I don't know, I feel like this whole Lindsay situation, it should be a great wake-up call to people to realize that even if they may not be necessarily abusive, granted, I don't think I ever was, that adding to these, I guess, pylons doesn't help in any way. Sometimes your voice isn't needed.
Generally not productive.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So
I also want to add that if there's one thing that frustrates me about the Lindsay Ellis situation is that she was ultimately harassed and forced into retirement due to what was ultimately a bad take in a tweet. That's all it was. And to be fair to her for one second, there's plenty of bad media takes on Twitter. I don't know why she had to go through so much shit for hers. But I think it's fucking garbage.
It was hardly her worst take, isn't it?
Right. Insane. I was gonna say she's had worse, but I think it's fucking insane to me that she's painted as this villain. Meanwhile, Doug Walker, who literally contributed to cover up of legit sexual harassment and potentially assault, is now considered good now because he doesn't mind that Oni plays fucking parodies him, and he likes Kingdom Hearts. Okay.
The priorities of the internet is fucked.
I said this before, but if the internet really wants content creators who like Kingdom Hearts, there's fucking plenty, and they're not problematic.
I think this also just highlights the inherent misogyny in how, you know, queer women are routinely harassed. Dogs.
Well, yeah, Lindsay and Natalie both very astutely pointed out that it's wild how this happens routinely to queer women in this sphere and not at all to the perceived cis men.
Right. It's fucking bonkers that happens. And it's led to, like, genuine harm. I wish more people had the reaction to this essay that I've had. because I feel like there's a lot we can do. Because I've always wanted the best for everyone, right? And I feel like people who I would say criticized her and stuff probably also did too. I mean, granted, I'm gonna scrub away all fucking right wing trolls that also threw into this mess as well, but
there are plenty of people who didn't mean anything by this, but there are also people who are just determined who disliked Lindsay to begin with and were determined to dislike her in the first to go on. Like,
right.
There are many people for whom there was never any good faith to any of this. This was a convenient excuse to feel righteous in your dislike of this person.
Right.
Right. When there's a lot of them who don't even give a shit about the issues they're apparently raising, so.
It's.
I don't disagree with most of what Lindsay and Natalie have had to say about this situation, right? Like, I just don't. They're entirely. Like, I remember what Natalie kept harping on in her canceling video, which was also, like, not perfect and has a lot of problems. But the thing Natalie kept pointing out that I think is absolutely true is that a lot of people really want to harp on this, like, this tweet that you made off the top of your head without thinking about it for 5 seconds versus, like, the actual, like, projects that these people spend like hundreds of hours making. Like, those are irrelevant to this conversation. It's the obsession with mask off and this concept that everyone's trying to trick you.
Mm-hmm.
I think is really unhealthy, and it really contributes to this, like, we have to suss out the bad ones who are hiding and pretending to be it's a refusal to actually acknowledge that there's diversity of thought and mistakes, and this complete misunderstanding of how people work also, I think, is a big one. Like, I remember Philosophy Tube mentioned this in a video back before she came out. So she was still presenting as a man. I remember she made this video where she was talking about basically that, like, at the height of Natalie's canceling, if that's what we're going to call it, just for the sake of the conversation, that, like, how frustrating it was to have all these people, like, coming after her, demanding that, like, she publicly renounce her friendship with this person that none of us know. And I find that to be, I've always found that to be a particularly insidious aspect to when this happens, is this, like, insistence that you publicly badmouth your friend because they did a thing that the internet is mad at them for. Whether or not you, like, let's even say that the thing that they do is bad enough that you decide you're not going to be their friend anymore. The thing where I have to come on Twitter and, like, announce that to you publicly is weird and invasive. It's like this complete failure to understand what real interpersonal relationships are.
Mm-hmm.
I've had friendships end badly and suddenly, and my instinct was not to immediately go and explain to everybody that, oh, I'm so sorry to have associated with this person. Like, it's just, it's weird. It's invasive, and this refusal to understand these are people, and perhaps if their friendship is ending, that's hurt, painful for them, and they kind of don't want to castrate themselves publicly on Twitter about it.
Because I shared some of these feelings of missing, like, the point. There's a way in which you dehumanize the subject, especially with these people, because they are internet celebrities, or I should say influencers or content creators or whatever, and they have a following. And that following can be equated to wealth and power And certainly there is power in their platforms. But these people are also content creators who maybe work with a small team of two or three people, maybe four or five. They don't have publicity people like celebrities do, right? That's not how it operates. And it's easy to paint them into a corner where they are the wealthy, you know, they're the wealthy people, right? These are people who have control or power, and it's easy to think about them in terms of that. And it's also easy to forget that they, since they have such hyper visibility, they're way more likely to see themselves constantly being dragged and to deny the traumatization that comes from that level of scrutiny. Like you tweet off this one thing, right? And it doesn't go over well. And it doesn't fucking end that it doesn't go over well. Like, it's constant. Like, imagine going to Twitter and seeing your name in the trending.
Ay, ay, ay.
Like, I don't know how you... I think I tweeted this too, but I don't think humans' brains are able to be wired to process literal thousands of people criticizing you.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
There's no way that you can actually take in that level of scrutiny in any productive way. Like, as much as it felt in the moment, someone who felt that they should apologize and who didn't really think about that, it's hard to, like, really grasp. It's easy to fall into being into denial of the humanity of people. Even when you don't realize you're doing it. Like, imagine if you tweeted something and you were forced to be told to just apologize, right? Like, you could apologize, right? It could be half-hearted. It could be truly sincere. And imagine that, whatever you say, not having any impact. Because the conversation is bigger than just you. At that
point. I also really aggressively agreed with Lindsay's point, which is that why are you valuing insincere apologies? This thing where you're just saying, well, just apologize. Okay, what if they're not sorry? Why do you want an insincere apology? And I think Natalie said this, but the faster an apology is, the less sincere it probably is. Because human beings are not wired that way. When people attack you for the thing you say, your first instinct will pretty much always be to be defensive of your point.
Uh-huh.
Like, if you want people to absorb the criticism you're leveling at them, you need to give them the time and the space to actually do that.
Right.
And social media is not conductive to that.
No, it is not.
It wants instant answers and instant corrections and instant perfection.
Yes.
And like I said, you know, I really do hope. I mean, I hope things are changing. I hope that this partially opens the gate, kind of like what it did for me. I don't know though. We are living in a time under intense, like, removal of civil rights, right? Intense fascist ideology being spread at a wide level. And it's terrifying, especially for people who care and who will be affected by this. Taking your energy and putting it into something that you feel you can control, even though it's ultimately meaningless, helps no one. And causes more harm, and obviously causes trauma and PTSD. Fuck. Oh.
So I think ultimately, I'm with you, Crystal. I very much hope that this is a lesson to people. It probably won't be, but I hope that it is. And I think whatever you may have felt about Lindsay in general, I think that this, I find this to be a sad thing. That she's no longer going to be making content. Because as I said, even no matter how much I disagree with her, I never felt her content to be without merit. I never felt her opinions were without worth of listening to.
There was no video of hers that I saw that felt like, I don't like it always felt fairly like, I wouldn't say standard, but I would say like common sense mostly. And I agree with you that it was like, I'm sure there was bad takes. I don't know enough of her content to really say.
I have a particular vendetta against her video about Stephanie Meyer, but that's a different conversation.
And granted, my frustration more stemmed initially from Natalie Wynn. And I've changed my thought process on that entire situation, like, utterly, completely. So, maybe others will, too. Maybe some good will happen. I don't know. I think having this conversation, though, is really important.
I agree.
I feel like there's a way to... Yeah, I think there's a way that we can have these conversations, be fair and balanced, and find new ways to engage online in a way that's healthier. I hope so. I have hope for people, but you never know. I don't know if there's any other things that you want to, that's been on your mind about this, that you wanted to unload.
I think real quick, I just want to lighten up the topic, since I think this might be a good place to potentially stop. Can I just say, I find it funny that the biggest invested Twitter feud at this point in time is Elmo and a rock.
Yes. Elmo and a rock.
Fucking Rocco.
Fucking Rocco.
Rocco's not alive!
You know what? If I was told that the cookie that was there was not going to be allowed to be given to me and given to a rock, I'd be pissed too.
Well, especially when you're 3 years old, like Elmo's supposed to be.
Elmo doesn't age. Elmo is an immortal child.
Yes.
Oh God.
I don't know why that honestly has been the funniest thing I've seen online in this sometime.
Oh God, now I'm imagining Elmo as the fucking ghost child from the end of Mass Effect 3. Holy shit. And that's the funniest shit to me.
Well, I will say, because I do gotta run very soon, but while we're on this topic, what's been super interesting to come out of that, actually, has just been this really interesting conversation, at least on Black Twitter and Black sides of TikTok. Has been people talking about how, because the reason Elmo's voice was voiced for like 30 or 40 years, something like that, by a Black puppeteer.
Yes.
Up until, I want to say, like 2014, he was replaced by a white puppeteer. And it's not necessarily that Elmo has a Black scent, as it were, but it's in this really interesting conversation about how, like, because a Black voice actor created this very distinctive voice for Elmo, there's a lot of cadence to the way Elmo talks. There's a lot of quirks to it that are very, like, that clearly come from African-American vernacular English. And listening to the way that has potentially been heightened or lowered since the white actor came in to replace him. I think Kevin Clash was his name, right? Who used to voice Elmo. Yeah, who came in to replace Kevin Clash. Like, it's just interesting. It's a very interesting conversation to listen to that, how AAV so prominently influenced the way Elmo sounds and the way Elmo now is always going to have to sound, because that is the most one of the most iconic voice performances probably ever in children's media. So, like...
Like, also, to end things off, here's a fun fact for you. The puppeteer for Elmo, Kevin Clash, also did the puppetry and voice for Master Splinter in the first two live-action Ninja Turtles movies.
Oh, I no think shit. I actually heard that before.
I think I had seen the documentary about him a few years ago. I don't know if you saw it.
I have not.
Okay.
But yeah, that's interesting. Yes, a fun lighthearted thing to end on. So.
Rocco's not alive.
Rocco's not alive. I'm Lizzie Lebendrop. You can find me anywhere I want you to find me at that at or as the final whore on TikTok. I talk about movies and such. The new Scream comes out this week.
I don't know when I'll see that, but
y'all are just gonna have anybody who has any form of interaction with me anywhere.
Fuck, I was gonna avoid it. I was gonna
prepared for that.
I was gonna avoid it just because the NFT shit I'm hearing about that came out about it, but fuck it. If I'm gonna be on this podcast, I might as well go see it so I can talk about it.
I was gonna say you don't have a choice here, Jazzy.
Yeah, there's no choice.
There's no options.
Fuck. Is this the price I pay for being in this show, getting rid of my morals? God damn it.
That's the blood contract you signed.
I end up hating this movie, I'm blaming both of you.
I'm hearing good things, and it's also directed by the directors who did Ready or Not, which that movie was awesome, if you have not seen that.
Oh, yeah. I was so excited when I found out that that's who was creatively taking on the new Scream. I was stoked, because I fucking loved Ready or Not.
Ready or Not, without spoiling, has one of the best horror movies and endings I've ever seen. I adore.
Oh my god, it's so good.
It's so satisfying. Jazzy, you need to see that.
I do.
Please do. I think you'll like it. It's good. It shows that they have a sense of humor, too, so... Even though the trailers didn't really show off the comedy. So anyway, Scream, we will have to talk about that. Jazzy, you wanna say where people can find you?
You can find me over on Twitter at Lady Jazzington. You can find me on Twitch under the same name. By the time this episode goes up, the following Saturday, we will be doing part 2. Of Kingdom Hearts 2, which I'm going to be streaming alongside my friend Shakira Dunn. We're going to be doing by the time this gets posted, we'll have already done the first part. And you can also find me on YouTube under Jazzy Oliver. It's mostly shit posts.
Thanks. definitely go follow Jazzy. And I'm Crystal Williams. You can follow me on Twitter at Crystal W. Rocks. You can also read my articles on my Medium under Crystal Williams, and you can listen to, I don't know, the times I've appeared on the Violet Wanderers podcast. So yeah, that's where you can find me, over there. Thank you for listening to the first episode of 2022. Let's hope that 2022 is an awesome year of new episodes and new content you all will enjoy. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Gals of Geekdom podcast. And we will see you on the next episode. Goodbye, everybody.
See yous.